Hi, everyone. I'm Salma Qureshi. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, the University of Texas at San Antonio's neuroscience research podcast. Today is April 30th, 2021, and we're talking with Sergio Ferreira, who is professor of biophysics and neuroscience at the Center for Health Sciences at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. He's also director of strategic partnerships and international relations at the Dorr Institute for Research and Teaching. Hi, Sergio.
Hey, Salma. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So Sergio's research program takes a biochemical lens to investigate mechanisms of Alzheimer's disease across progressive scales of analysis through behavior to identify and test potential disease-modifying therapies. His recent work targets brain protein synthesis and degradation pathways to restore defective synaptic plasticity and memory in animal models of Alzheimer's disease. So joining us in the circle, we've got two of our ranking Alzheimer's specialists. We've got Hyung-Gon Lee, who everybody has met before. Hi, Hyung-Gon.
Hi.
And we've got Chris Gamblin, who is new senior member of our faculty, who's a tau polymerization specialist. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
So I find, I'm thinking about where to start, I thought this idea of studying Alzheimer's as a pathology of proteostasis just is so intriguing and inclusive of so many of the different and sometimes competing areas in the field. So proteostasis itself is a massive space that concerns regulation of protein biogenesis, folding, trafficking, and its degradation within and outside the cell. It also just, it seems really critical here that it bridges the divide from biochemistry to getting at the dynamics of behavior by directly determining the structure and function of synapses and therefore the memory networks and the cognitive networks that are impaired in AD. And that seems to be a really important leap that I don't know that we've discussed really, we've gotten into sort of that meta level and integrative level here in the podcast series yet. So Sergio, could you start us off by saying something about the clues in the AD brain that have led to this idea of a pathology of proteostasis and introduce some of your work, maybe defining how A-beta oligomers impact proteostasis to get us into it?
Sure, Salma. So the point you raised is a very good one. So I would say the initial clues as to why defects in proteostasis are implicated in Alzheimer's came from the original work by Alois Alzheimer himself more than 100 years ago. So in 1906, as we know, Alois Alzheimer described the report of his first patient, Augusta D., who had been under his care in Germany for a number of years, and she had this very profound form of dementia, early onset form of dementia. She was still in her 50s when she first was admitted into the Frankfurt Asylum, where Alzheimer worked back then. And so what Alzheimer found by inspecting her brain after she passed away was that there were these massive clumps in the brain, both extracellular and intracellular clumps that he didn't really know what they were made of course, but he described them as abnormal pathological hallmarks of her brain. And then it took about 80 years for us to begin understanding really what those deposits or plaques were made of. So initially it was found that the extracellular aggregates are made up of this peptide called amyloid beta, which aggregates and forms these large deposits in the brain, outside neurons. And then at about the same time or a little after, we discovered that the intracellular aggregates or intracellular inclusions were made up of another protein, which is Chris's favorite protein, I think, tau, which when hyperphosphorylated, aggregates and form these large aggregates called tangles. So clearly, because we see these large deposits of proteins that should not be there, there was something wrong with degradation of proteins. And degradation is the endpoint of a protein's lifetime. So that's the equivalent to a protein's death. When it's finally degraded by a cell, And these two clues, which go back more than 100 years to Alzheimer's original work, told us very clearly that there were defects in degradation of protein in the M portion of proteostasis. Now, on the other hand, the other important set point is the beginning of the life of a protein, its birth, or protein synthesis at the ribosome. And we know from work, lots of work has been done by memory specialists, not people devoted to Alzheimer's necessarily, but people looking at basic biology of memory, how memories are formed and stored. It has been known for quite a while now that protein synthesis is an essential requirement for memory consolidation. So clearly, protein synthesis, the beginning of the life of a protein, is essential for memory, which is disrupted in Alzheimer's. So we figure there should be a biochemical connection, a direct biochemical connection between those two things.
So in terms of the idea of proteostasis, I mean, I have to admit, I'm fairly ignorant and I didn't necessarily learn about this in terms of these like integrated networks, like, for example, the integrated stress, or is it the ISR, the integrated stress response, which is this whole series of interconnected, I mean, I'm actually not sure what it is, but I know it's incredibly important, and there are tools and assays to measure it and look at it and what happens in various Alzheimer's models. Can you say something about how we are now able to study proteostasis and when that change happened? Because it seems like every paper now has some component of ISR, and like it's almost as though it's like the final common pathway in some ways for so many kinds of dysfunctions. So can you say something about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think the ISR is a really key focal point of a cell's life, indeed, because that's the way cells respond to the environment, and but actually not only to the external environment, but also to the internal, to changes in the internal environment and what goes on in the, within the cell.
And it traverses biosynthesis and degradation. It sort of kind of connects.
So when we think about a cell, let's think about what's going on right now during the COVID-19 pandemic. Our cells are being attacked by this virus. And for some individuals, for some cell types, the virus will be able to actually infect the cell and get into the cell. So once the virus is recognized as being within the cell, how does the cell react? Is it going to lead its normal life? No. The virus is going to try to take hold of the protein synthesis machinery to make its own proteins in order to make more copies of the virus and spread to the rest of the organism. On the other hand, our cells react or respond by recognizing that viral infection, that the presence of the virus as a stress, a form of stress, which activates a specific kinase, which we've been looking at, called PKR, which is double-stranded RNA dependent kinase. And that's just one of the several kinases that's part of this protective system, which senses the environment and tries to respond, to make the cell respond in specific ways to prevent further damage. So when the cell is infected by a virus, what should the cell do? Try to stop protein synthesis, because that will stop the virus from replicating. And that's what we do with the aid of PKR, for example, with this particular kinase. Now, if there is a lack of nutrients, lack of amino acids, the same should happen. I mean, the cell should shut down its global protein synthesis and focus only on those few proteins, which are really essential at that time, at that point in time, to make it, to enable it to face the challenge of nutrient deprivation. What happens, for example, if there is a form of stress that either heat or whatever, there are heat shock response proteins in other cell forms that respond to heat stress. There's all sorts of stress trigger specific responses in cells. And these responses are executed, or the effectors are kinases, proteins that go on and phosphorylate target proteins to either promote or shut down specific processes. So it's really a key network of kinases that orchestrate this stress response in cells.
So Hyung-Gon, both you and Sergio have worked on AD as a metabolic disorder of the brain, specifically the cognitive impairments could be related to a state of brain insulin resistance or brain diabetes, I guess. Sergio, your work has posed that that presumably ISR, that this neuronal stress signaling via EIF2 alpha, one of these factors, which is I presume a regulating factor for the ISR within the ISR, maybe you can help situate us, that this is a molecular link between Alzheimer's and diabetes. It sort of connects the two. Can you say something about that and connect us into metabolic stuff as well and where that's situated in all of this?
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. I think one in which Yonggang may wish to add something as well, but what we've been seeing in our studies for the past 15 years or so is that glucose metabolism is affected in Alzheimer's, but especially insulin signaling is affected in AD brains. And not only in actual human AD brains, but also in several experimental models of AD, which allows us to study those mechanisms in more detail than what you can expect to be able to study in a postmortem human brain, for example. So because we are able to recapitulate this insulin resistance that goes on in actual AD brains in vitro in the lab or in experimental animals in the lab as well, then we can study those. And what we found is that not only insulin receptors are internalized in neurons exposed to A-beta oligomers, so that's one of the key points, because if the receptor is no longer at the membrane, how can insulin possibly signal to that neuron? But in addition to that, and we find that the intracellular pathway that's activated by the insulin receptor is also downregulated. So really, it's kind of a dual attack on insulin signaling. Not only the receptor is downregulated, which is already quite an impediment to signaling, but the downstream signaling pathway inside the cells, inside neurons, is also downregulated or inhibited. So, and we think that has a lot to do with memory and how memory gets dysfunctional in Alzheimer's.
So that is super interesting, because it seems like a lot of the discussion that we've had over the years surrounding Alzheimer's disease has hinged on some of the disconnects or some of the contentiousness between the different types of animal models and which one is really how artificial are they and how much are they really aligning with the true syndrome. It seems like looking at being able to assay in detail the sort of biochemical network that's surrounding perhaps this ISR, perhaps other types of coordinated networks, could be a way to sort of assess and align some of these things and sort of organize some of these animal models. Are there any thoughts about that?
Of course, one needs animal models to be able to really tease out the mechanisms for any disease, including Alzheimer's disease. And I think there's only so much you can expect to gain in terms of mechanistic information by looking at actual postmortem brain. So you can probably do correlations, associate biochemical alterations in the brain, but it's hard, if at all possible, to really establish a causal relationship between something that you see in the Alzheimer brain and the outcome, memory deficits, because you never know whether that's really causal, or whether it's an epiphenomenon or a consequence of an underlying pathological mechanisms. Now, in animal models, we can study those in much more details. So we need those. The main criticism, I think, for the most of the existing animal models, largely mouse models for Alzheimer's, is that most of them are based on genetic mutations, which are found in familial cases for Alzheimer's disease. And the critic is that these familial forms of AD do not comprise 5% of all AD cases. They're less than 5%. The vast majority of AD cases are those which we call sporadic AD. And it is quite possible that there is some genetic inheritance involved, and there are some genetic risk factors known. ApoE, for example, the epsilon 4 allele of ApoE is the main risk factor known for that, but there are other risk factors as well, including those involved in an inflammatory response and microglia, for example, which have been discovered in recent years. But the point is that these mutations only affect really a small proportion of the AD cases. And thus, by studying a genetically modified mouse that has those familial AD mutations, what we're actually looking, if we think about it more strictly, is at what may be happening in the familial AD brains, not in the sporadic AD brains. And that's why I think a few years ago, we invested some effort into developing this more acute model, which has its drawbacks, I admit. It's not a very progressive model. You know, damage takes place over the course of 24 hours. You can already see memory impairment. But what we do with the model that we developed is inject into the brain ventricles a preparation, a very well-characterized preparation of soluble A-beta oligomers. So there are no plaques, there's no amyloid fibrils in there. It's just soluble species. And we inject those oligomers at a very low amount, like really in the picomole range. And that tiny amount of A-beta oligomers is sufficient to induce most of the pathological features of Alzheimer's, including tau hyperphosphorylation, brain oxidative stress, which is something that Jung On has worked a bit in the past as well, quite a lot, and insulin resistance. You know, all sorts of pathological features that we find in the actual AD brain are induced by this tiny amount of A-beta oligomers that we inject into mice's brain. And the most important, they exhibit memory impairment as well. So it is a relatively quick and easy way to induce what we think is sort of an acute form of Alzheimer's that we generate in the lab. And I think that's a good model. We have been investing in collaboration with colleagues in Canada at Queen's University, Fernando De Felici and Doug Munoz from Queen's University. We have been investing some effort in the development of a non-human primate model for Alzheimer's as well, which brings, you know, considerable advantages in terms of brain complexity, of course, because as we know, monkeys have, their brains are much closer to our own brain than a mouse brain. So by studying how these monkeys react to A-beta oligomers infused into their brains, we can also gain closer knowledge of what's going on in our own brains when our brains get filled up by oligomers.
So I was just wondering, how much is known about the diversity of atlas structures?
Can you define ADDL structures?
What's
the acronym? I wrote
amyloid
it down.
Amyloid diffusible ligands. So the oligomeric form. I mean, is there much known about the actual molecular structure of those? And is there much diversity in Alzheimer's disease, either within a patient or between patients? And does that change the activity?
That's a very good and very complicated question, Chris. So when Bill Klein first developed this procedure to prepare these oligomers, he called them ADDLs for A-beta-derived diffusible ligands to really stress the fact that they are diffusible, they're soluble, they can really diffuse within the brain. Now, most generally, they are known as A-beta oligomers in the literature. So we basically refer to them as oligomers to really try to distinguish them from fibrils. So they are not amyloid. The name of the peptide happens to be amyloid, but it could be anything else. But historically, it was named amyloid because it was isolated from amyloid deposits in blood vessels and in the brain parenchyma. So that's how it was discovered. So it was named after the amyloid plaques. So it makes sense, of course. But the oligomers are not amyloid. They do not have the cross beta sheet structure that you find in long amyloid fibrils and the long polymers that are amyloid fibrils. So they do not bind For example, thioflavin T, which is this classical fluorescent marker for amyloids, they either don't bind or they bind at very low level thioflavin T. And if you run a gel and a Western blot, you find that they range in the preparations that we use, which follow the original Klein recipe, we find that, that those oligomers range from dimers all the way to maybe 24-mers, but nothing bigger than that. There are other groups that report oligomer preparations containing much larger oligomers, like in the 500 kilodalton range, which would be about maybe four or five times larger than what we have. And in addition to that, there is diversity, as you mentioned. So even in an in vitro preparation of oligomers has at least two broad classes of species, what we call the low molecular mass oligomers and the high molecular mass oligomers. So the low would be dimers, trimers, tetramers, which many groups have shown to be very active at synapses and to exert really profound detrimental effects on neurons. And a lot has been published on small oligomers, dimers and trimers and tetramers. We tend to find in our studies that in our hands, at least, the larger molecular mass species are more toxic. So typically, and those are also very abundant in the 80 brain. You can also find lower molecular mass species in 80 brain, but it has been reported by several groups that 80 brains contain this species that's the 12-mer of 54 kilodalton, which was originally termed a beta star 56 for 56 molecular weight, because that's where it appears to on a Western blot. And so this a beta star oligomer has been shown to be quite abundant in 80 brains. And we find, we actually developed a specific antibody a few years ago in collaboration with Bill Klein, and we published this, I think, 3-4 years ago in the Journal of Neurochemistry, where we developed this single chain antibody that specifically reacts with a high molecular weight fraction of the oligomers, and it completely abolishes toxicity. So we think that although oligomers exist in different flavors, maybe those 12-mers or so are the most toxic to synapses.
Hi, Sergio. So like you just mentioned that, you know, there are, I think there's still debate is actively going on that, you know, which one is actually really important, you know, species in the oligomeric A-beta, like A-beta star 56 or, you know, dimer. And then I think you're finding, like you just said, that, you know, your research basically indicating that the higher molecular weight, like, you know, A-beta star 56 is more important than the dimeric form. But would it be possible that, like, you know, like you showed in your research clearly, the high molecular weight oligomer A-beta may be related with more with like a proteostasis or some toxicity, but in at the same time, like Dennis Selko group to show that multiple times, like maybe dimeric protein is causing some other neural dysfunction in some deeper way, not exactly the way you did. So it's going to be more, you know, mechanism. And we all know that it's more complicated. So maybe that's kind of can we can explain that why that, you know, we're kind of, even though just oligomer, we are debating which one is more important and which one is actually a toxic molecule here.
I think that's a great point, Yoga, because, you know, as a biochemist, I've always been very much intrigued about this biochemical diversity of species that Chris alluded to, and to what which of those species could be more toxic, and whether they all have the same toxicity or whether maybe one of them is more toxic to a certain particular outcome and the other induces certain other things. So coming from a biochemical training, one thing we did in a paper we published in 2013 was to separate oligomers into two large fractions by HPLC. So we separated the high and the low molecular weight species by HPLC, and then we infused them separately into mouse brains. And we looked at what happened. So it was intriguing because when we did this experiment, and looked at what happened to synapses by doing immunohistochemical analysis of synapses, looking for a marker of the presynaptic terminal, synaptophysin, we found that only the low molecular weight species affected the presynaptic marker that we looked at, synaptophysin, in a persistent manner. So if you infuse mice with a preparation that does not contain a beta 56 star, for example, but contains dimers, trimers, and tetramers, you actually damage synapses. If, on the other hand, you infuse mice or you treat neurons in vitro with the high molecular weight fraction above 50 kilodalton, then what you find is not a structural damage to synapses, but inhibition of memory, which can be reversed actually by memantin, which is the drug that we know is the only drug that's still available that was introduced in for Alzheimer's in the past 20 years, and induces oxidative stress through NMDA receptors, through the activation of NMDA receptors. So I think that actually both small and high molecular mass species are active. It kind of depends on what you're looking at. If you want a more acute impact, probably the high molecular weight species will show you that because they affect receptors directly, like the NMDA receptor. If you're looking for more long-lasting changes, maybe the smaller oligomers will be more active.
So you're differentiating these based on the extracellular interaction. The two species, so one of them interacts directly extracellularly with the NMDA receptor, because the localization you showed was completely dendritic, right? So it was parasomatic.
Yeah.
So the assumption is that there's something about the synapse that these
sure. And this is like the, $100 billion question, I think, that you're asking, Salma, because what is the receptor? If we learn what the actual receptor for a beta is in the brain, we'll cure Alzheimer's, because we can come up with drugs to really block that interaction and probably cure it. The problem is that each group publishes a different receptor. So in my group, for example, we believe the NMDA receptor is very much involved in the in triggering most of the responses induced by A-beta, specifically by A-beta oligomers. On the other hand, we ourselves published not too far ago that another postsynaptic protein called neuroligand is also a receptor for A-beta oligomers. And interestingly, this, I think 2 days ago in Nature Neuroscience, there was a paper showing, which really I love when I read it, because they show that the NMDA receptor, neuroligand, and CAM kinase 2, which is a kinase that is deeply involved in the regulation of synaptic function and NMDA receptor responses, mediated responses, they all coalesce, they form a condensed in a liquid phase, in one of these liquid phases that have been shown to exist. They're not really organelles in the sense that they are not separated by a membrane from the rest of the cytosol, but they exist as a sort of a droplet of protein, sometimes with lipids involved, and they form this sort of droplet that exists in the cytoplasm. So they're all sort of teaming up together. So, but there are many other candidates. I mean, for example, the prion, the cellular prion protein has been reported to be a receptor for beta oligomers. And there are many people that believe firmly that the prion protein is a receptor. F2B, which is another protein, synaptic protein, has been shown to interact with the beta oligomers. There are many, many, there are like 20 some candidate receptors that have been published so far.
No, I agree that because of, my own lab, our research, we also have been studied about the prion protein as an oligomer receptor. And then, when we initiated that project, we were kind of skeptical, whether that's the real receptor or not. But our data clearly show that a prion receptor is partly responsible for the oligomer A beta toxicity, even we didn't look at whether that's a high molecular weight or low molecular weight. But like I agree with you, the point is kind of a very complicated matter. But my view is that probably they are all receptor, different type of receptor we have identified so far. probably they all kind of, you know, doing so in that way, or maybe they kind of, you just mentioned that, you know, they kind of come together and they make some structure, you know, you mentioned the intercellularly, but also in that plasma membrane, like a membrane surface area, maybe something happened. So it's kind of leave it a less specific way to activate all the receptor, because you know, our own research demonstrate that we published the data, we show that the inhibition of prion protein partially reduced oligomeric toxicity in brain, but we haven't reached all like 100% recovery, not all the time. And then I think I have looked at other research too, like for example, like NMDA receptor, I think they also showed a very similar outcome. You know, they always show like maybe like 50% or 30% of recovery of the toxicity. So I think that data probably suggesting us that, you know, maybe this is kind of a multiple receptor involved or multiple mechanism involving, like we, you know, talk about it. So maybe that's why, you know, we only take the one pathway. We only going to see the partial kind of prevention or the recovery in here.
Yeah. And then if you want to make things really even more complicated than they already are, until recently, tau was considered to be an intracellular component of the pathway, of the amyloid cascade pathway. And tau was envisioned to be perhaps a consequence of amyloid beta, but still to affect many dysfunctional events within cells as well. But now this vision has totally changed by what we learned about the existence of tau oligomers, which can actually be transferred from cells to cells. They can be exported and they are found extracellularly. They can be involved in spreading of the disease to different brain areas. They can bind to a totally different set of receptors. Nobody knows really what they bind to yet. So it's a very complicated disorder. No wonder we haven't come up with a treatment for it yet, because it's not a single target disease. You know, there are multiple receptors that are involved in amyloid beta, probably multiple receptors involved in the binding of tau oligomers as well. So it's not an easy task.
Do these elements interact directly with microglia? Because the pro-inflammatory response of microglia, you've written about the fact that a lot of these non-cognitive symptoms of AD that are more related to mood and affect, that they may have some common microglial mechanisms with more of the cognitive stuff. So is there a direct, is that a point of interaction that we know about?
Yeah, I'd say definitely.
Direct interaction.
Oh yeah. I mean, we ourselves published, but other people have shown this as well. We published studies showing 5 years ago, we published a journal or a science paper showing that oligomer, A-beta oligomers directly activate microglia in culture. So there are no neurons, no astrocytes there. It's a pure microglial culture. You add oligomers to those cultures and the microglia, boom, they respond to those oligomers by producing nitric oxide, by producing IL-1 beta, by producing TNF-alpha, and secreting those pro-inflammatory mediators to the medium. And in vivo, by injecting oligomers, we find that those same cytokines are upregulated by oligomers. So, and if we block microglial activity with, for example, minocycline, or by depleting microglia with a drug that kills microglia specifically, we can actually show that these cytokines are no longer produced in response to A-beta oligomers. So clearly, microglia are direct targets. There can also be a lot of communication between neurons and microglia and astrocytes. And this is, I think, possibly the hottest area. I would venture to say that this is perhaps the hottest area in research right now in Alzheimer's, understanding how neurons, which are always thought to be the most spectacular cells in CNS, how they interact with these other spectacular cells, which are microglia and astrocytes, and how that helps memory, but can also lead to memory dysfunction when that goes, you know, crazy. And
right. This artificial distinction between pro-inflammatory being good or bad and anti-inflammatory being good or bad, it totally breaks down, because prolonging inflammatory effects is actually really good for myelination, remyelination. Of course, there's some adaptive stuff that's really important. But then again, there are all these I mean, this ISRIB, this the ISR inhibitor is just has blown up and is just incredibly therapeutic in your hands for resolving.
Yeah, well, many people had shown that ISRIB is very good at therapeutically speaking in animal models of trauma, for yes. example, in TBI. There is a great paper by Mauro Costamaccioli, who's also from Texas, from Baylor. There is work in vanishing white matter disease. There's work in prion disorders by Giovanna Malucci's group in England. So there, ISRIB has been shown to be very effective therapeutically in mice, of course. The challenge is going to be, and then we found it in Alzheimer's in our hands. So the challenge is going to be whether one can actually administer ISRIB safely to people, especially considering that Alzheimer's is a chronic disorder. So it would not be a matter of giving ISRIB for a few days, but rather for many years. So is it safe to do something like that? Can we come up with other drugs that have a similar effect, but are safer and less toxic, for example? So those are challenges that I think the proteostasis area is now trying to address.
I want to end on this idea of the fact that Alzheimer's is so difficult to match. I mean, we can't prevent it because there are no early markers. It's difficult, or is that true? Last time I checked, I mean, are there biomarkers at this stage? I mean,
well, yeah, there has been an amazing development of the use of phosphorylated tau in the blood, in plasma, as a biomarker. This is something really very recent. You know, a year ago, papers were published showing that in addition to looking at tau in the CSF, which has been done for many years now, but it's very cumbersome. You need to do a lumbar puncture.
Prior to disease onset, these are early biomarkers? Yeah.
Prior, well, it depends on what you define as disease onset. And that's another point.
Yeah.
You know, when you first see biomarkers changing in Alzheimer's, it's probably already late. The earliest, the better, of course. Right now, if you wait for a person to really show PID positive plaques in the brain or even tau deposits by PET scanning in the brain, it's probably too late. So by looking at what goes on in plasma, it's not only much easier, but you can actually do follow-ups, you know, look at that kind of preventatively. You know, if you have a family history of Alzheimer's, or if you're beginning to have subjective memory complaint, which is those little forgetfulnesses that we all occasionally have, but if it gets to be a little more often than normal, then you can presumably get one of these tau plasma tests and see if tau is acting up in your plasma or not. And so that already opens a window into earlier detection. But perhaps, and I think this is one thing that Jungon is quite interesting as well in relation to his work on metabolism, perhaps by improving metabolism, we can actually prevent or delay the onset of Alzheimer's. If not prevent, if we can delay it for 10 years, that's already a tremendous bonus. And maybe we can do that by adopting a healthier lifestyle, you know, watching a little better what we eat, preventing diabetes, preventing obesity, exercising. We have published work showing that there's a specific hormone that's released by muscle upon physical activity that prevents memory impairment in mice. So perhaps physical activity, a combination of all these things, you know, social interaction, which of course is harder to do during the pandemic, but this is not gonna last forever, I hope. And you know, keeping your brain active in general. So I would say these common sense things that we sometimes neglect. You know, it's easy to go on a really Western diet and forget that it's not healthy. You know, eating fast food every day is definitely not healthy for your brain, as it's not healthy for your muscle, for your adipocytes, for your liver. So whatever is not good for the body is not going to be very good for the brain, and vice versa. What's good for the body can actually help your brain. So I think there is hope for prevention as well.
So that would have been a beautiful note to end on, but as always, I'm going to ruin it by just saying one more thing. So the cell signaling paper, which I haven't seen in PubMed, that's forthcoming.
Science signaling.
Oh, the
science history signaling. Paper.
Yes.
The history paper. Yeah, that's science signaling. 2 months ago.
Oh, it's in the. It's. I wasn't able to locate it. Anyway, so what was super compelling about this in your acute model, not only are you able to prevent memory loss through the ISRIB treatment, but you're also able to rescue memory. And I know that it's a huge leap, and you know the model, these are sort of things that are constrained by the model, but that seems to me is the kind of thing that people are going to run with potentially, that there is a way, you know, barring complete cell loss, that there is a way to sort of kick things back into gear to get, you know, the machinery, the microtubules and whatever it is that is needed to create synapse could potentially be rescued at some early phase, you know, sort of maybe through a combination of delaying onset of the disease through healthy living, and then potentially sort of slowing things and then rescuing whatever has happened when we get a good marker. I know you're going to be very cautious about this because it's so model delimited, but can you just say something about what the feasibility, how people should be thinking about this in terms of rescue versus prevention?
I definitely need to go slow in this and be very cautious, as you said, but you know, being a biochemist myself, of course, my first initiative would be to look for a drug and a way to really turn back time. You know, if your brain is not functioning well, can you do something, add something that will rescue it? And I think the paper that I came out a week ago by Ana Maria Cuervo from New York, showing that autophagy can actually be rescued. Time can actually turn back by adding a specific compound that improves autophagy in models where autophagy is disrupted.
The word rejuvenate is being used.
Rejuvenate, yeah. So that's, I don't think they use that term in their paper, but that's what I would say, that they've managed to rejuvenate autophagy, which is an essential component of proteostasis, by adding a specific chemical compound. So I think ISRIB or something related to ISRIB holds good promise. But as you pointed out, you know, mice are very far away from humans. It's very easy to cure disease in mice. You know, there are literally hundreds.
Especially when you created it, right?
Yeah. There are hundreds of examples of drugs and treatments, either pharmacological or non-pharmacological, which work very well in mice. Mice promptly recover from whatever illness you induce them to have, but that they do not translate to humans. So the major bottleneck is translation. And that's again where I think the non-human primate model might fit very nicely in the story. Maybe, of course, you're not going to do screening with those models because there's only so many models, non-human primates you can use in a given experiment. They have to be very carefully monitored, and it's a tremendous infrastructure required. But for those drugs that really you want to put your money on, you know, because they work superbly in mice, and you think they might actually translate into humans, maybe that the monkey model would be a good way to bridge that. So that's something we have been trying to do as well.
I just want to add one point that, you know, my idea to regarding the animal model, like you explained, I think your direction is great. Like I also that your edition study in the monkey, that was great. And then I believe that you are now moving the preclinical clinical trial or clinical trial pace, I guess, that probably you guys are working on it. But in addition to that, I think the main issue for the animal model now, like including your model, is that it's still, we are very, you know, like you said, the mouse and human difference, of course, that's the case. But more importantly, all the mouse model or the monkey model, it doesn't recapitulate all the things happening in the Alzheimer disease at all. Like, for example, like, you know, amyloid pathology and the tau pathology and then something else, you know, all combined. So maybe I think the better approach, or you know, maybe that's probably a more richer idea and then a more efficacy study. Like, for example, like your ISRIB study, Maybe you can try that. I know that, you know, you mentioned that, you know, that compound already tested in the many different conditions is highly effective. So maybe it's just a bit of that protein metabolism at a kind of a general mechanism. I totally agree with you that because all the evidence indicates that the metabolic change is kind of like, you know, very important critical mechanism causing neurodegeneration. So maybe we can try, you know, any compound we develop idea, if it's not specifically targeting, like for example, like A-beta vaccination, if we just target the some cell mechanism underlying it, then probably we should try in the multiple direction, like a model design, like, you know, APP mouse model, like you have it. And then also of course, the, you know, the genetic model, and also, you know, tau mouse model too, we could test the way, or inflammation model or some other model we can develop, like a TREM2 model like that. So if the compound is working equivalently, that all model overall, then I think probably we could have a better idea whether this compound is eventually gonna be translatable to the human. You know, I think I understand that that's gonna be the shortcoming at that point, but I think that's, I think that probably that we can do because we don't have, you know, the such an animal model now. So maybe at least we can try the way to validate that which you know that target and a compound might be eventually working in the human.
Everyone's running for the patents now, right? After yes. Thank you. Did you want to end on something, Sergio? Sorry, did I preempt you?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here. So yeah, unless there are any specific issues that you would like to have addressed. And, yeah.
I think I talked too much, but thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you all so much.
Super fun. Thank you, Sergio, Chris, Hyung-gan, and I'm Salma Qureshi. This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.